Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is your good friend, the very esteemed and well-travelled Clarence Copernicus Cloverleaf, welcoming you to another exciting edition of Cloverleaf Radio, hosted by the host with the most, Jimmy Falcon. You can always feel free to call in at 602-753-1883 to ask a question to the host or any of his well-established guests. Just please remember when calling in to be on your best behavior. This is a G... Good evening. This is your good friend, the very esteemed and well-traveled Clarence Copernicus Cloverleaf, welcoming you to another exciting edition of Cloverleaf Radio, hosted by the host with the most, Jimmy Falcon. You can always feel free to call in at 602-753-1883 to ask a question to the host or any of his well-established guests. Just please remember when calling in to be on your best behavior. This is a G-rated show, you know. Hey, that was a wicked rhyme. Anywho, just be sure to be kind and courteous. Now, on to the main event.
How you doing? This is Trevor Murdoch, a.k.a. Jethro Holiday. You're listening to Cloverleaf Radio, hosted by my friend, James McLovin Falcon.
Oh, man, that's an old promo. We are back for another exciting edition of Cloverleaf Radio. I'm the host of most, Jimmy Falcon. And we are honored today to be welcoming actor, producer, editor, special effects artist. This guy has done a ton more things I probably can't even name. He's done so much. Wyatt Weed is with us. How's it going, man?
It is going good, sir. It's going very good.
Well, that is good to hear. I thought it was pretty cool to find out that you were originally a Central Illinois boy like myself.
Yes, born and raised for the first 12 years anyway in Springfield, Illinois, and then I spent 4 years in Champaign-Urbana, and where Dark History is going to be, and then I moved down to the Edwardsville area. But you know, for the last couple of years, I've called St. Louis home. So, but yeah, I get all around the Midwest. I do conventions all over Illinois in the Midwest, and yeah, you know, when you were young, I don't know if you went through this. When you were young, Illinois and Springfield was like the place you wanted to get out of. And now I really enjoy coming back here because it's quiet and it's calm and everybody's cool. And I get sick of the, you know, I get tired of the big cities sometimes. I go home to Springfield and it's like, everything's nice and calm here.
I live outside of Mattoon. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. It's about 45 minutes south of Champaign.
I have heard of Mattoon. I don't think I've ever been through there.
Well, it's about 18,600 or something, so it's not a huge town, but it's got some people there. I can agree that I think overall growing up in any small town, whether it's in Illinois or the Midwest or anywhere that's small and there doesn't seem to be much to do, you want to get out of that town, and I think maybe that's why I started doing radio, too. I had aspirations to get out of the place I'm still at, but you do get tied to your community, and I think that overall it's better to be in a smaller place than a huge, giant metropolis.
Well, and with the technology now, you can do a radio interview with just about anybody. That's the cool thing. I mean, back in the day,
right.
Yeah, they had to be, like, sitting there in the studio with you or it wasn't happening. And now with the internet and the technology and the cell phones and stuff, yeah, you can – anyone can be, you know, a mogul. So that's a great thing about it.
Absolutely. Well, I guess starting off with growing up, being that you were, grew up and spent some years in Central Illinois, was it your dream to always get into filmmaking or being an actor or anything involving entertainment?
It was kind of a progression. I remember the first thing I wanted to do, the first thing I can remember doing, because I'm a kid who grew up with the space program and the moon landings, for the longest time I was certain I was going to be an astronaut. But then in the mid-70s, there was a string of movies that came out that kind of got my attention, and the first one was probably Jaws, which, you know, I saw Jaws, and I was like, you know, big mechanical shark, boat in the water, shooting out in the ocean, that must have been interesting. So I started buying up all the making of books, and I kind of got obsessed with King Kong and the stop-motion and animation of King Kong, but the one that did it was in 1977, you had Star Wars in the summer of 77, and then you had Close Encounters at Christmas of 77. And I was hooked. I mean, Star Wars did it, but then Close Encounters kind of sealed the deal. And by 1978, I had found a Super 8 camera, and I was making movies. And I have not stopped since then. Since I was probably about 13, 14 years old, it was movie maker, actor, you know, all of the above. I wanted to do all of that.
Yeah, Star Wars and Close Encounters definitely had to have been two of the biggest films to come out of the late 70s. And being that Close Encounters was even based around Indiana at some point, so that
sure
has to feel, you know, it's always cool seeing something based near at where you're living.
Yep. Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly.
And since you mentioned that, it's not quite Star Wars, but you did appear and worked on some Star Trek episodes. That had to be a pretty cool experience. It all kind of falls into the outer space and technological.
Yes. Star Trek The Next Generation, I moved out. You know, I worked as much as I could in the Midwest. I moved down into the St. Louis area in the 80s, and, you know, there was opportunities here, but it was like cable television and working on local commercials, and once in a while a film would come through, and so many people wanted to get on the film. Whatever came through town, you'd all fight to get a position on the crew. But it was pretty limited. I continued to kind of perfect my filmmaking skills, but then in 1988 I decided to move out to Los Angeles, and I'd been out there working for maybe about a year and a half, and I got a chance to get cast on Star Trek The Next Generation, and that was quite an experience for a lot of reasons. I mean, I was, you know, I was always an original series fan, and Next Generation, I liked it, but I didn't have the passion for it that I had for the original series. But I was smart enough to know that if I got on Star Trek Next Generation, I was going to be on TV forever. I thought, God, if I get on an episode of Next Generation, it's going to be in reruns literally for the rest of my life. I will always be on TV if I get on Star Trek The Next Generation. So I passed the audition, which was basically looking the part, and then I got to go in for fittings and had my own custom costume made. And then the first day actually shooting on set, the first person I met was Jonathan Frakes, who plays Commander Riker. And then Patrick Stewart walks up, and then Michael Thorne walks up in his Worf makeup, and it was an amazing experience. They were all a lot of fun and really cool to work with, and I think for me, I considered myself a professional actor, but when even actors get starstruck, and boy, just being on that set, it was all I could do to just be cool, not lose it, not be a big geek. And so the challenge for me there was just be professional, be cool, don't blow it, just, you know, do your job and hang out with these people and, you know, don't act like a fool in front of them. But it was an amazing experience. It really was one of the best times I ever had in Hollywood.
Yeah, I think everybody, even if you get to a point where you're like a Johnny Depp or Cameron Diaz, you know, they still have legends in their mind that working with them just makes them, you know, try not to freak out or mark out, as we always said in wrestling. But it's always, there's always someone that you're going to be humbled by, and it still happens to me on the show. It's always nice talking with anyone who's made an influence in my life, and it does make you kind of want to fanboy it out, so to say.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you ultimately find out you're all just people, and you're all just, you know,
right,
you're all professionals, and you all do the same thing. But yeah, you just can't help but, you know, have that reaction. What's interesting, though, is, you know, we all feel like we know who these people are. And to a certain degree, you do, because they're on TV, they're in interviews, they're in magazines, and you think you know who they are, but meeting them in person is always just a little bit different, because then you're finding out who they really are. And sometimes that's disappointing, and sometimes it's awesome. But, a few people know some of the stuff I've done, like, okay, yeah, Star Trek, and yeah, I was a Predator in Predator 2, and that's all cool. But I just can't imagine, like, being as famous as some of these people are, because it's just got to be, I mean, just imagine not being able to walk around the street any day
right.
and not be recognized. That would be crazy. You think you want it. You think you want that kind of fame. And I don't know if it would be fun. Sometimes it's weird just to be at a convention and somebody walks up and starts crying because you were, you know, a no-name character in Star Trek The Next Generation. I can't imagine what it would be like to really, really be well-known like some of these people are. It would be a trip. It would really be a trip.
Yeah, it has to be taxing and very stressful on anybody, especially if you have to basically become a recluse just to be able to live your life and not be constantly hounded. You can't go out to eat. I was thinking the other day, you know, having a nice dinner out at a restaurant. And I was thinking, man, just think if I was famous and I could not sit and eat this in peace.
Yeah. Yeah, be careful what you ask for.
Absolutely. Yep. And before we move on to the work you've been doing recently, I did want to ask about Predator 2 because I don't believe I've seen the original one, but I definitely have seen the second one. It was probably one of the first horror films I saw way before I should have, but it had a great all-star cast in it. What are your fondest memories of working on that, and how did all of that come about with you getting the role of the Boar Predator?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I'll try not to make it too long, but I had seen the first film before I moved out to Los Angeles, because the first film came out in 1987. And by the way, you have to go find the first film and see it. If you haven't seen the first film, you got to go check it out. Whether you like the other films, I think the 1987 first film is probably the most well-made, and it really established so much style and so much of the tone and the theme of the Predator films. But so I had seen the first film. I was a huge fan. And then when I went out to L.A., I started working with one of the guys who was one of the main Predator designers, and his name was Steve Wang. Excuse me. And his whole group of people that he worked with, they all were involved in Predator to one degree or another. And I got to know this stuntman named Brian Simpson. And that's important because something that a lot of people don't know is when you're watching a Predator film, if the Predator is on screen with a human, then it's a really tall actor. Back then it was Kevin Peter Hall, and I don't know who the new guy is who's playing the Predator, but they're getting tall guys so that the Predator looks huge next to humans. When the Predator is doing stunts, when he's flipping around on rooftops or jumping through treetops or falling off a cliff from an explosion or something, that can just be a regular stunt guy. When he's not on screen with somebody else, it can be a regular sized guy. Like, I'm 6'1", and Brian Simpson was 6'1". So what happened was, when they started working on Predator 2, they had this scene at the end with, like, these 10 Predators showing up at the end of the film, and they had suits left over from the first film that Brian Simpson fit. So they took one of his original Predator suits and they repainted it and they put some new details on it and they gave it a new bio face mask and they made a new Predator out of it. Now, when it came time to shoot that final scene with all the Predators decloaking and surrounding Danny Glover, Brian was unavailable. They wanted to put him on second unit and send him off to go shoot another stunt sequence on the film. Well, all of a sudden, here's a Predator suit that's empty, and they need somebody to fill it. And because Brian had worked with me before, and he knew I could do creatures, and he trusted me, he said, "Well, call this guy, call Wyatt Weed, get him to put him in my suit. He'll fit my suit." So if you can imagine, it's like I'm not kidding, I'm not exaggerating. It's like a Monday night, I get the phone call saying, "Hey, man, you want to be a Predator?" And like Tuesday morning, I'm in the Predator suit. That's literally how fast it happened. And again, much like Star Trek The Next Generation, I had to keep my cool. It was like, oh my God, I'm going to be a Predator. This is the most amazing thing ever. I'm going to be a monster. I'm going to be one of the greatest creatures ever created in movies. I'm going to be a Predator. So I think some of my favorite memories of that film, because it was fast. We only shot, they shot for, I think, 2 days on that end sequence. I was only on the second day, and that was when all the Predators decloaked and surrounded Danny. And we were shooting fast. We were shooting scenes fast. We were moving quick. There wasn't a lot of time to hang out and screw around. But I just remember Kevin Peter Hall being a really warm and friendly guy. He was really, really nice. There was some humor. There was some moments of, you know, guys screwing up on set and the director joking and everybody laughing. That was a lot of fun. Stan Winston came walking through at one point and said hello to everybody. So I got to meet Stan Winston. And then the only reason I have photos of myself in the costume is we weren't supposed to have cameras. We weren't supposed to take pictures. It was all top secret, but I snuck a camera in my bag. And at one point when we weren't super busy, we all had handlers. So each one of us had somebody assigned to us to help us get in and out of our suit. So I turned to my handler and I said, "Hey, can you snap a couple pictures?" So we snapped a couple pictures real fast and then hid the camera. But then, of course, the difference then and now is these were, you know, this was film and I had to go make film prints and it wasn't digital and you couldn't instantly upload it to the internet. So I sat on these film prints forever and, you know, they didn't really see the light of day until a few years ago when I started going to conventions and, you know, appearing as a predator. So, but no, just the overall experience was really great. Seeing those people work. You know, you go on these sets and you get to see how these professional crews do things and you learn. But you know what? I think I figured out the moment. The moment for me was walking on that set for the first time and seeing the trophy cabinet that had all the skulls in it. And that was kind of the moment of we all kind of knew that Predator and Alien were in the same universe, but it hadn't really been confirmed. Right. And I walked on the set and I was one of the first guys, like in the industry, who walked on set and saw that alien skull in that trophy cabinet. And I was like, aha, there we go. They're in the same universe. So I could go home and tell people, oh, hey, by the way, alien skull in the Predator's trophy cabinet. So that was a really cool moment, was seeing that skull in there for the first time. That was really awesome.
Yeah, Alien versus Predator was a really awesome film, in my opinion. And, you know, I'm sure figuring that out and kind of foretelling time, so to say, had to be pretty awesome. And getting to meet Stan Winston had to be pretty cool as well, because his studios put out work, special effects work for such legendary films like Jurassic Park, of course, Predator and Aliens, and so many more that had to be really awesome. How was the suit as far as, I think it would be pretty warm.
You know, it was warm. It wasn't as bad as people think. Like, if you've ever been scuba diving, you know, you put on the diving suit and it's like the rubber wetsuit. So imagine the suit wasn't really any worse than having on a wetsuit. It was just the amount of time. I think we were in that thing off and on for like 14 hours that day. And so the first few hours weren't so bad. But, you know, as time wore on, it just kind of cramped and you felt kind of claustrophobic in it. And a lot of times when we weren't shooting, they'd allow us to take off our hands and our heads and then they'd unzip the back of the suit and you could get a little air in. So it wasn't as bad as you imagine. And of course I was young. I was in my 20s. I was healthy and vital and good to go. But the worst part of it was there was a scene where we decloak for the first time. We come walking in out of the vapor and we appear for the first time. And they did that with a computer-controlled camera that could it would repeat the moves. So it would shoot the scene once without us, and then it would shoot the scene again with us so that they could make us appear and decloak.
Wow.
And so the camera could be a little touchy. So it was like you're in full gear, you get your helmet on, and off the set was fine. Once you went on the set was like this huge fiberglass shell, and it was backlit with lights so that it was glow, and then it was smoked up and fogged up inside. So off the set was okay. On the set was being in an oven. And if you were moving and circulating and breathing, it wasn't so bad. But we were standing still on our marks, getting ready for them to call action, and the camera kept fouling up. So it'd be like, get set, ready, wait a minute, okay, hang on, okay, ready, set, okay, wait, hold on. And that went on, I'm not exaggerating, for like 10 minutes. So I'm standing in full gear on the hot, smoky set, in position, waiting to go, and that's, I think, as close as I've come to passing out in my adult life. And my vision started to get narrow, and you know, my hearing started to get a little hollow, and I just concentrated on breathing and concentrated on my vision, and I kind of came back, and then they finally called action, and we finally went, and I got moving again, and I was okay, but that was the closest I've ever come to just buckling over in heat.
Oh, my goodness.
So, but then, like, we'd have lunch break, and, you know, then we could get completely out of the suit at lunch, and I want to say, if memory serves, I feel like that was the best lunch I ever had on a film set. I feel like they fed us, no kidding, I think they fed us steak and lobster on that set that day. So if you can imagine working on a film set and eating steak and lobster, I do think we got fed steak and lobster that day. So, you know, there were perks. There were perks.
And after all the steak and lobster you consumed, you decided to move back to St. Louis, Missouri, and start making your own movies. Why did you decide to strike out on your own, so to say? I'm guessing it was something you had dreamed about after when you were doing all these acting.
Well, you know, the crazy thing was is when I first went out to L.A. all those years ago, you learn, you have ideas in your head, and you learn things. But I imagined, you know, there are actors who acted their way into directing. There were guys like Robert Redford and Warren Beatty, and those guys had become actors, and then they'd moved on into directing. Well, once I got out there, I figured out that any one of these things is very difficult to do just by itself. Just being an actor is hard. Just being a director is hard. Just being successful at anything in Hollywood is pretty tough just on its own. And I was interested in so many things. I honestly think that if I had it to do over again, I'd focus more on one specific thing instead of spreading myself so thin. I mean, I wanted to act, I wanted to direct, I wanted to do special effects, I wanted to do all these things, and I did all those things. But, you know, I think if I had just focused on being an actor or director, I think I could have succeeded earlier and you know, earlier while I was still in Hollywood. Now, on the other hand, I'm a jack of all trades. I literally can do anything. I mean, I just about anything in filmmaking, I've had some experience with it, and I know how to do it. But, you know, I started getting up about 40 years old, and you start realizing in Hollywood that, you know, they don't hire first-time screenwriters when they're 40. They want 20-something-year-olds who know what the kids like, and they don't hire feature film directors to direct big, massive Hollywood films who are 40-something years old. They get young commercial guys who've done this stuff. So I started realizing that I had kind of backed myself into a corner in a lot of ways. But then what happened was this digital technology started getting so good. And as soon as digital started happening, I was keeping an eye on it. And I was watching filmmakers, and I knew guys who were buying digital cameras and experimenting with them. And right about 2004, 2005, 2006, I started seeing short films and amateur projects getting done that were looking really, really good. I mean, the digital technology was getting really strong. So I had made a film in Los Angeles called Guardian of the Realm. It was directed by a friend named Ted Smith, but the producer was a guy named Bob Clark, and Bob Clark lived in St. Louis, and we'd all been friends back in high school days, but Bob Clark, he, like, financed the film, he executive produced the film, and he did it in L.A., but he didn't like L.A., he didn't like the experience, and he wanted to keep making films, and he wanted to keep doing production, but he wanted to come back to St. Louis and keep doing it here. And he basically started talking to all the people that he knew and said, hey, do any of you want to come back to St. Louis and work in this production company with me and let's make some movies in St. Louis? And I was the only one who was like, yeah, get me out of L.A. If you've got a production company and you're willing to finance some productions, I'm willing to get out of here and come back with you.
Wow.
So, yeah, he basically set up the production company. He bought a lot of nice equipment. And we came back to St. Louis and started doing short films. And then our first feature film was a vampire film called Shadowland. And we've done another feature since then, a bunch of short films. We did the Dark Knight film, which was a Batman film. And in the meantime, we do a lot of corporate and commercial stuff, and that pays the bills. But I got to tell you, having come back to St. Louis now, it's so much easier to work here. I mean, Los Angeles is cool. There's awesome things happening there. It's really where the heart of the film industry is. But in St. Louis, you know, things are cheaper. It's easier to get around. Locations are easy to get. People are still excited about movies. They're thrilled to be involved in movies. It's just, there's so many great unused locations here. And there, and the skill is really here. There are great people here in the Midwest who really know what they're doing. Now, I can't make Terminator 2 in St. Louis. I can't make Titanic in St. Louis. We don't have that kind of technology. But you can do just about anything else in St. Louis, and it's so much easier and cheaper to do it here. So I literally get more things done and have more creative freedom here than I ever did in Los Angeles. And I still have friends and connections and people out there that I talk to and deal with, but I'm really enjoying being here. And, you know, it's kind of the business decision to make yourself a big goldfish in a smaller pond. You know, out there I was a tiny little minnow with a million other minnows. Here at least, you know, I can get things done and, you know, have a reputation, and, you know, people are coming to me for stuff now. So it's really fun. It's really been a good move, you know, coming back to St. Louis.
And the air quality is better.
Oh, good Lord, yeah. Yeah, the air quality is better. You know, there were days where I'd be in L.A., and I lived in some places on some big main streets in parts of the city, and you'd forget where you were because the air was so thick that you wouldn't see, like, the ocean, or you wouldn't see the mountains. And then one day you'd come out and there'd be good air quality, and there hadn't been good air quality in months, and you'd be surprised. You'd look down the street and there would be snow-covered mountains, and you'd go, oh, holy cow, I forgot. There are mountains right there. But you hadn't seen the mountains in months. So if you can imagine living in a place where there are mountains and not seeing them, that's what living in Los Angeles was like sometimes. So,
just ignore her. I know you're hearing the what I have labeled the annoying British woman.
Yes.
Yeah, she likes to interject and give me crap, but we won't get hung up on just yet. I did want to, before we were done, of course, you're going to be at Dark History and Horror Con with us. And you mentioned you've been doing cons for a couple years, so I think it's going to be a really awesome convention. I think you're going to enjoy it. Brian is a great guy, and gosh, this will be like the fifth year in a row I've been a part of it. So he really puts on a great family product and really treats all the guests and vendors very, very well.
I'm really looking forward to coming back to Champaign-Urbana because I was there. I was only there 4 years, but it was four great years. It was like my junior high school years and my the first couple of years of my high school, and just a great town, you know, great people. I love going back there. So to go back there as part of a con, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I think you'll be surprised at how big Champaign has grown now. It amazes me just how big it's gotten in the last 20 years. It's really a place to spend some great time in. Lots of great restaurants and so much entertainment possibilities.
Yeah, and it's going to be fun to let my friends know. Hopefully they'll come out. I go back there whenever I have a chance. So then when Brian said, hey, do you want to come back for a convention? I'm like, Champaign-Urbana and a convention? This is, you know, I can't lose. This is awesome. This is the best of both worlds.
Yeah, he told me you're really excited, and I think that that excites him as well because, you know, we're all in this for some fun, and he definitely strives to bring it to the area.
Well, and my wife and I, we just came back from this convention, Midwest Monster Fest up in Moline last weekend. We just came back from that, and we were talking on the drive, and we were talking about how, you know, we don't really want to do conventions full time, but we enjoy doing the conventions as long as they're fun. And that's the thing about it, is so far they've been fun. You know, going out and meeting fans, hanging with fans, they're so enthusiastic. You see all the great artwork that the individual artists do. You see all the other filmmakers come out with their horror films. You know, you get to meet all these people, and everybody wants to be there, and they're all happy, and they love movies, and they love horror. And it's a lot of fun, and you're traveling to these great little towns that you've never been to before. Well, last weekend anyway, I've been to Champaign-Urbana, but last weekend I'd never been up to the Quad Cities. So you're seeing the country, and you're meeting great people. And as long as it's fun, we're going to keep doing it. So, I mean, yeah, it's nice to come out and make money. It's nice to come out and sign autographs and go home with a little bit more money in your pocket than you left with. But it's not. It's never been about just making money for me. It's the fun. I'll stop doing it when it stops being fun. But, you know, for the last couple of years now, it's really just been a blast to go out and do these shows. I've really enjoyed doing it.
It is. It's really a lot of fun. And I think you're going to enjoy all of us because we're a crazy bunch, but we're a fun bunch. I guess the final thought would be, what does the future hold for you? Where can people find some of your work and see what everything you've got going on coming up?
Well, I've got a website that I should blog on far more often, but some of my stuff is up on my website, and that's wyattweed.com. And then I've got a YouTube channel. I'm Wyatt Weed on YouTube, and that's where some of my short films are. If you've never seen my Batman fan film, I did a Batman fan film called The Dark Knight Returns, which is an adaptation of the first issue of the Dark Knight Returns comic series from the 80s that Frank Miller did. And then I've got a couple other fun short films on there and fan films on there. For me, there's a couple of things in the works. I want to do more Batman fan films. I'm working on another short Batman film right now. And next year, I would like to do another feature. And I've got a couple of straight dramatic films that I want to do. But next year, I want to do a horror film. And without giving away too much, this horror film is going to be about, you know, you saw the Momo thing that hit a year or two ago, where it was the Momo challenge, where it was the scary thing that was, you know, on the internet, and it was challenging the kids to do all kinds of horrible things. Well, this has to do with the internet and downloading things that you shouldn't download, and how horrible that can get, and all the bad things that can come of it. And I want to do it with as little dialogue as possible, and I want to make it pretty much about one guy alone who's dealing with all these horrors that come about. And like I say, without giving away too much of it, that's about as much as I can say. But I haven't really gotten – I mean, my film that I did, Shadowland, it's a vampire film, but I think it was more action than straight horror. This I want to be scary. This I want to be something that, you know, scares people, makes them jump, makes them afraid to turn the lights off, makes them afraid to go to bed. And that's what I want to do with this film. I want to get back to basics and make something that's really, really creepy and scary that just, you know, that just unnerves you when you watch it. So that's kind of in the short term. I want to start working on that next spring.
Some of the scariest movies or clips in films I've seen were the ones where there was no dialogue.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a little bummed that there was that film that came out last year, A Quiet Place.
Yeah.
And that was very similar to an idea I had for a very long time, and they did a good job, so congratulations to them. I was just bummed because I had an idea like that, and I don't think my idea is going to work now that they've done that, but kudos to them for getting it done. That's one of the things about Hollywood, man, is you, when you have a great idea, you've got to get on it because somebody else sooner or later will do it. And they did it, and they did it well. So I'll put that other idea away, and maybe in a couple of years it'll be new again, and I can do it then. But that, you know, that happens.
Yeah, Quiet Place was really effed up, and I think John Krasinski and Emily Blunt did wonderful jobs in their roles.
Can you imagine a husband and wife team that's that good and that talented? That's just they are an awesome couple. They're really amazing.
And especially seeing him in all the comedy films I have of his, seeing him you know, do a whole different turn. That's always great for an actor to be able to pull that off.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, thank you so very much, Wyatt. I can't wait to meet you at Dark History and HorrorCon. I think you're going to enjoy yourself and have a good time with all of us.
And I want to let anyone who's listening know that if they've got Predator stuff, bring it on out. I'll sign it. I don't charge to sign stuff like that. I mean, if you've got a Predator 2 poster or a Predator 2 comic book or something, yeah, bring it on out. I will be happy to sign it. I've got stuff available if you know. I'll sell you an autograph. I'll sell you some Predator stuff. But yeah, bring your stuff out. Just come say hi. Get a picture taken. I'm very easy to deal with on stuff like that. I'm not William Shatner asking $250 for a photo op. I'm pretty down to earth with that stuff.
Well, that's awesome to hear. Yeah, I do have my Predator figure set aside that I was planning on bringing. So
very good.
Thank
very
you
good.
For being humble. I appreciate that. I think it's appreciated in conventions because there is those opportunities like William Shatner or Adam West back in the day that can kind of break the bank.
Yeah, and you know, it's sometimes it's hard enough and it's expensive enough to travel and get a hotel room, and
yeah.
Sometimes shows can be expensive to get into, and then you go in and you've only got limited dollars left. So, I mean, I'm a fan, too. I go to these shows, and I'm like, okay, I got this much money. What am I going to spend it on? Am I going to buy this? Am I going to buy this? And I know you have to make choices. So yeah, I'm appreciative that people come out. So the last thing I want to do is gouge them. So.
That's very awesome, Wyatt. Thank you again so very much. Best of luck with everything you got going on in that new film. It sounds creepy awesome.
Cool. Good deal. Well, thank you. This has been fun.
Absolutely. Thanks again. Have a great night.
Okay. All right.
All right, guys. Big thanks again to Wyatt Weed. And, of course, Dark History Horror Con is coming up October 26th and 27th, 2019 at the City Center in Champaign, Illinois. Be sure to visit dhhtown.com for more information, up-to-date ticket information, guest announcements. Of course, Wyatt Weed is going to be there. Lots of really awesome. I'm going to actually pull up this site real quick. I hate trying to name people off the top of my head. It's never good. Jose Santiago Jr. is going to be returning. Of course, he's been on Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, and has a new film out that he helped create as well, called Joanna. They're working on, should be out very soon. Of course, some other alumni, wonderful people I've had the honor of talking to. David Thibodeau is going to be there, of course, the survivor of the 1993 Waco siege. Bob Elmore, of course, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. He played Leatherface. Eric Berner is going to be there, the author, and I believe he's actually doing films and stuff now as well, a.k.a. Corvus Nocturnum. My old pal John Borowski is going to be there. Scott L. Schwartz is going to be there, 6'8". Well over 300 pounds. He's been in a lot of very awesome films. Worked with the likes of Jim Carrey and Ben Stiller and numerous others. So I think you should be joining us at Dark History and Horror Con if you are in the area or are in driving distance. It would be well worth your time. We will be back. See, I'm speeding up my talking because I have about 4 minutes left, a little under five. So trying to wrap this up. September 22nd, we welcome the return of HSPPA owner James Azrael. Of course, HSPPA is a very awesome organization. James has collected for many years screen used props and very awesome things. He's big props, small props. I'm trying to pull up his website. It's never easy to try to multitask. I know I've said it before, you just can't. Horror and Sci-Fi Prop Preservation Authority. He goes to conventions and numerous things and sets up this museum. It's a not-for-profit museum of screen use and production made props, costumes, and film relics that focus on horror and science fiction genres, with a sub-branching into the superhero comic book, fantasy, thriller, and action genres. HSPPA champions a collection and restoration of some of the most incredible screen use props in cinema history, and we are honored to share a selection of these on rotating exhibits at Spooky Swirls. HSPPA was formed in mid-2015, as the traveling museum has created over 60 individual exhibits and conventions and movie theaters across the country. Currently, the museum stands at over 3,000 props and 1,000 costumes for films like Aliens, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, Friday the 13th, Part 7, Roman numerals, Beetlejuice, American Horror Story, Star Wars franchise, Aquaman, Harry Potter franchise, Silent Hill, Dogma, Thor, Fantastic Four, The Strain, Hellfest, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Total Recall, Halloween franchise, Buck Rogers, John Wick 2, Ash vs. Evil Dead, Arrow, Death to Smoochie, and so many more. There's an incredible 25 active event curators and nearly 20 featured exhibitors spanning the globe. From 2018, West Coast and East Coast branches of HSVP began enabling us to reach more locations with greater ease. And although it wasn't a screen used, I did donate a couple pieces to the HSVP here from my personal collection. They have now a piece of John Denver's Death's Airplane, as well as a rock from the crash site of Patsy Cline, country music and pop superstar. So very honored that James took those and has them in his collection, and hopefully they make it out to one of these traveling museums or over at Spooky Swirls. So we'll be seeing him on the 22nd. Big thanks again to Wyatt Ween, and thank you, everybody, for joining us. As always, have a great night.